Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. I took some time off to focus on our spiritual community here in Raleigh and for a family vacation, but most weeks I post some thoughts here to help get a conversation started about hammering out a viable and a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, and I hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment, and thanks to the many who have. On that point, I understand how sex is such a personal topic, but I would like to encourage those who do comment to sometimes use the blog or the Facebook page, as well as the private messaging that I've been receiving. That way, other people can participate in the conversation. And again, at the end of the book, I'll turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin this week's episode titled, Sexuality for a Lifetime, Finishing Well. Now, before I went on break, we were talking about broadening our understanding of sexuality by tapping into the wisdom of the ancient Greeks. They, we saw, had a richly layered and a nuanced understanding of sexuality and love. We looked at five Greek words, five associated constructs about sex and love, and we've stitched those Greek words together to see how they form a developmental journey, a journey that unfolds our sexuality over a lifetime. Now, last episode, we focused on one of those constructs, one of those words, pragma love. This time, I want to focus on two more, mania and agape. As we've seen, for historical and economic reasons, in our own society, the institutions that most focus on sexual training are our economic institutions, and in particular, our marketing engine. The motivation of our marketers, of course, is to move product. Consequently, they use sex to sell. And consequently, they depend heavily on the parts of our sexuality that evoke hunger and longing and yearning and desire. Of course they do. That's what they want their potential customers to feel. But consequently, they focus on and they only use part of human sexuality, part of the sexual journey. It's a sliver of sexuality that they focus on, but we've seen that that part, the erotic part, fits into a much broader journey that is part of sexual development. The focus of marketers is on the get-the-ball-rolling stages of sexuality, the part of sex with a lot of chemistry in the mix. But they ignore the keep-the-ball-rolling stages of the journey, the parts that are more about the character of love or the character of our attractions and attachments one to another. And because the marketing machine in our society is so ubiquitous, and because it has such unfettered access to us through so many media outlets, many people in our society, and especially our young people, make an erroneous assumption. We assume that the way that the marketing machine defines sexuality, we assume that's the whole story. We assume that the quick and the intense and the visual and the erotic, the chemical side of sexuality or the volatile falling in love side of sexuality, we assume that's the whole thing. So in our project, we're going back into history, back to the ancient Greeks, looking to rediscover a broader sexuality with a wider scope. Now the Greeks, they positioned sexuality under the heading love. They positioned eroticism and mania, the chemical side of sexuality, they put it as part of the evolution of human love. In their understanding, sexuality and love contained eroticism, but also contained much more. In their understanding, sexuality and love contained enough developmental human experience to carry us through a lifetime of ever unfolding, ever deepening experience of our sexuality. Now, our society's limited marketing machine version of sexuality, it's just not that comprehensive. Now, as you'll recall from earlier episodes, the Greek word mania speaks to the obsessive madness we associate with that experience that we call falling in love. We'll come back to that in a moment. You'll also recall that the Greek word agape speaks to the culmination of the sexual journey. We arrive at the agape stage of love not because of chemical attraction, but as a result of an arduous journey, a transformative journey. As two people go through the five Greek stages of love together, this very special relationship, it transforms us. The sexuality journey, worked out over decades with another person on the journey with us, this alters us. It changes us. It goes deep into the wiring of our souls, and it reworks us from the inside. It makes us more deeply human. It certainly makes us more deeply, more comprehensively loving. It converts a self-focused way of love, the way of the young, into an other-focused way of love, the way of the elder. Now, we sometimes see this deep alteration when it has happened. We see this deep love in older people who have walked this journey. And consequently, we see kindness and goodness worn into the faces of these older people after years spent working the sexual process. What we don't do is realize that this deep process, this deep stage of love, is the natural destination of the sexual journey. In fact, we think of older people, we tend not to think of them as being sexual as much as the young. But that's simply because we're working with the limited marketing machine definition of sexuality. The Greeks had a much more comprehensive understanding, and they called the culminating stage of love, they called it agape. Agape loves from a different place inside of us. It loves from a different version of self. Now, having walked the sexual journey, having experienced each stage and then carrying that stage with us into the next, having gone through mania and eros and philos and pragma in a deep and committed relationship with another person, and having dedicated ourselves to that person and to the process, the journey changes us through the decades. When agape love has found root in our hearts, we love not because of anything our beloved does or does not do. We love not because of any return that we gain from our affections. No, in the agape love stage, we love simply because it has become our nature to love. Agape, again, is the love of the elder. It is the love of the mature, the love of the developed. Now, when the ancient wedding ceremony speaks of marriage as a sacrament, as a holy thing or a sacred thing, it's referencing this transformative process. Elders love because it has become their nature to love. Elders, through being in this relationship through the decades, have been changed into love. Love is not a thing that they put on or take off. It's hardwired into their very being. That's what happens when two people travel this comprehensive sexual journey together. That's what the process does to us. Now, when you see agape love in the life of the mature, when we encounter that, it is really a wonderful thing to behold. It is so profound that it sometimes evokes language that seems more spiritual than sexual. When we experience love this deep, it feels divine. It's so much bigger and truer and more beautiful than the love that we would typically experience in daily life reality, that when we encounter it, we default to language of majesty. We speak of God or spirituality or holiness or mysticism. We cast about for words that are big enough to contain the weight of this encounter with this deep form of love. But because of this struggle for words in my own life, when I grew up in church, nobody really told me that agape was the love of the human being, the love of the elder. They taught me that it was the love of God. So I assumed that it was only God that could love this powerful way. But what I miss is that as we unfold the whole experience of sexuality, the whole experience of love, and we do it over a lifetime, the journey changes us. The journey itself has a stubborn tenacity, and it carries us toward agape, toward selflessness, toward this selfless kind of love. It carries us to a state of being where love becomes our natures, and that becomes our nature. That's what elders are. They are carriers of selfless love. That's what makes them elders. Now again, what few of us in our society can articulate or understand is that this is a sexual journey. It is a sexuality journey. We arrive at this depth of human experience as we travel through all the stages of sexuality and love. Consequently, we understand sex much bigger than merely eroticism. A long-lasting relationship between two people on this journey together is not the only way that people arrive at agape love, but it is the most common. People in monastic communities committed to their fellow monastics, they experience the same transformative process. Artists in their fevered commitment to creating. Caregivers in their deep commitment to those who are in need. People who serve others in hospitals as social workers, as teachers, or as ministers. they also experience this transformative process. But in our limited marketing machine definition of sexuality, if eroticism isn't part of the journey, we don't think of it as a sexual journey at all. But that's only because we've taken a part of sexuality and we've called it the whole. When we rip eroticism from its whole process context, as we've seen, we limit ourselves. We tend to, in so doing, overemphasize some parts and underemphasize others, and inevitably we end up causing ourselves pain and loss. So I want to come back to the stages of the in the journey, in particular, that we're focusing on this week, and look at the first one and the last one. I want to look at the link between mania and agape. Mania, falling in love, is an important part of the process. We've seen it has a strong chemical component. We've seen that it happens in our reptilian brains. It functions below the level of executive function. It is primal and it is deep. It's like breathing and heart beating. But what makes it so important for the sexual journey is how closely it resembles agape. The beginning stage of the sexual journey looks a lot like the final stage. During the mania stage of the journey, the beloved can do no wrong in the eyes of the lover. We just don't see one another's flaws. And during the agape stage, though we're not blinded to the negative traits of the beloved, those traits just don't matter. And so again, we don't see the flaws. In both stages, agape and mania, the beloved is loved, period. Both loves transcend what the beloved does or does not do. Mania and agape love are quite similar in this way, and it's easy to miss how mania, that powerful chemical experience, points us forward in the journey. It gives us a glimpse of where the journey will take us. Sure, it's an unsustained glimpse, but it's an important one. It's a motivating one. Psychologists tell us that mania, falling in love, or cathexis, that's the word they use, they tell us that this is a mind trick. Under biological and psycho-emotional influences during this stage of the journey, we drop our ego boundaries. We psychologically merge ourselves with the object of our affection, and our libidos overcharge us with energy, and we fixate on the other. We're consumed by an unsustainable influx of mental and emotional energy focused on the other. And as we saw in an earlier episode, under the influence of this madness, we are blinded to the practicalities of life. And in particular, we are blinded to the flaws of the beloved. Now, it's a good thing that this happens. You and I are here on the planet. The species has survived because we do this thing. But the mind trick nature of mania doesn't devalue it. Quite the contrary. Mania points us to the end game. It's a chemical pointer to an experience that will eventually transcend chemicals. It serves as an important launch pad. It carries us forward. It carries us into the deeper experience, into the agape love experience. When we fall in love, it's a magical thing. We are washed over with love. We are filled up from the bottom with love. It's a form of madness, magical madness, mania madness. And when, as elders, we experience agape love, we are also filled up from the bottom with love. We are also washed over with love for the other. But this time, it's a more permanent feature of our being. This time, it is a transformed character kind of experience. We have become what in the early stages we only felt. The chemistry feeling early on points us forward and sustains us through the rough and tumble journey of love and sex. Several years ago, one of the young people in our community was on the verge of a full-blown drug addiction. It's one of the most heartbreaking things in life for a family or for a spiritual community that has loved a young person from their childhood. It's one of the most heartbreaking things to see them fall into the destructive cycle of drug abuse. And I was meeting with this young person to check in on how their recovery was going. And I was asking them about meetings and about the steps they were working. And in the course of our coffee together, I asked what it was about drugs that had gotten so deeply into them so quickly. You know, this young person told me, when I take drugs, it's like I'm being wrapped in liquid love. Liquid love, that was the term, liquid love. Now, that's an odd phrase. It's not part of everyday language, but the funny thing was, I'd heard that term before. I had been reading the spiritual mystics and how they tend to speak of the ecstatic kinds of feelings that they encounter when they have direct touch with divine life. Their spiritual quest is to move beyond institutional religion and experience first-hand encounter with spirit. And as they struggle to speak about their experiences, experiences that don't really lend themselves to words, that term comes up, liquid love. There's something about in direct encounter with God or direct encounter with spirit, something about it that is captured with the feeling of being engulfed in love, soaked in a warm liquid, soaked in liquid love. So it struck me odd to hear that language in two such opposing places, spiritual mysticism and drug addiction. So I said to my young friend, I think your experience on drugs is an important one. You should pay attention to it. Now, you've already seen the toxic side effects of trying to get to that experience by using drugs, but that doesn't mean that getting there isn't important. And together, we begin to speak about the spiritual journey and about direct encounter with spirit and life and about the long and arduous spiritual journey that we undertake in order to feed that deep hunger we have for ultimacy. Well, in a sense, mania and agape function the same way. The falling in love chemicals get us on the journey. And when they do, they infect us with a vision. They give us a hunger that can drive us to go the distance to consummate that journey, and they can sustain us, and those chemicals sustain us over the long haul that it takes to get there. The madness of mania points us. The madness of mania motivates us, sustains us on a very long journey. Mania is not the whole story. In fact, if that's the only part of love we ever get, we are left stunted. You maybe heard the expression, falling in love with falling in love. It speaks to getting stunted or getting stuck in that powerful stage because it is so evocative. However, mania points us towards something that is very important. It begins as a chemical process that connects us with a person. But that connection then pushes us to other, deeper ways of connecting with that person. And as the process as a whole unfolds over a lifetime of transformative processing, we are changed. Now, I was given a gift more than 30 years ago. It was a gift of a book, but it was also a gift of understanding. Someone gave me a glimpse of what we're talking about when I was quite young. I came to see that sexuality is a developmental journey, broader and deeper than just eroticism, when I was just a kid. It was in the early 80s. Now, at the time, I was dripping with hormones. I went bald very young, and I'm told it's an excess of testosterone that makes that happen. So, yeah, I was drenched in erotic sex chemicals. And in my state, it would have been no stretch of my imagination to think that eroticism was the whole sexual story. But again, I was given a gift. This book, and it planted a seed of perspective, the perspective that I can articulate today. You've probably heard of the book. It's called The Road Less Traveled. It was written by Scott Peck in the late 70s. It sold about a trillion copies back in the day, so it was on everybody's bookshelf, and I was given one, and it changed me. In it, the author taught me about cathexis. And I learned that it was a brain trick, an important thing, but it was a brain trick. I learned that falling in love was the initial stage of a very long journey, the things that I'm telling you today. I learned that the erotic energies that were overwhelming me at the time were only the beginning of the journey. And I learned that walking this love journey with another person changes our character over a lifetime, over a lifetime. I learned that this journey leads us inevitably to the place we love selflessly, where we commit ourselves in love to others. And as overrun by erotic desire as I was at the time, that bigger vision of sexuality, that bigger vision of love, that was deeply compelling for me. The book taught me that our drive to connect, our drive to be with someone, to be with them as intimately as possible, the book taught me that the erotic energy that drives us toward that intimacy is not only a drive to ejaculate. I mean, thank God it is that, but that's not all it is. More deeply, it is a drive toward personal growth, and it is derived toward spiritual growth. Now, way back then, I learned that if our development is arrested in any of the early stages of the sexual journey, it has a toxic effect on our lives. He also used that word cathexis, what we call mania love or falling in love, and taught me that it tricks us by causing us to collapse our ego boundaries. Under the influence of mania love, our brains conflate the other and the self. In other words, when we fall in love, what we're actually doing is being drawn to ourselves in a shape of another person, which doesn't, it turns out, have much to do with true or authentic or mature love. It's a good book. I bet it's still around. You should read it. But back then, I learned that as we walk this pathway, this long pathway of sexual development, we arrive at a much deeper place. Instead of loving the other because our ego boundaries have collapsed, after a lifetime of loving another person, we are able to love other people because our ego boundaries have expanded, not collapsed, expanded. Traversing all the stages of the sexual journey with another person for a lifetime, we are expanded as human beings. The me that I become over time is extended, it is expanded, it is broadened. I am able to love more than just me. That's what the process does to me. I am able to love more than mine. That's what the process does. I begin to extend my ego boundaries beyond myself and beyond my people. This kind of love expands our experience of ourselves. We're no longer limited within our own bodies or our own egos or our own selves. We get bigger as beings. We become able to encompass others in ever-broadening circles of compassion and care. The journey makes us capable of reaching out to and nurturing and caring for the other with the same passion and energy that we had once been reserved for the nurture and care of myself or my people. Ever-widening circles become beloved to us. Over the course of years working the stages of the sexual journey, years of loving more and more broadly, more and more deeply, there is a progressive enlargement of the self. What started as a special erotic relationship with one expands into a sexuality that transcends eroticism. We become able to incorporate more and more people, more and more of the world, and we become able to love wider and wider circles because we are being changed by the process. The further we extend our capacity for love, the more blurred the distinction becomes between me and them. This is what happens to people who walk the full sexual journey, not just the marketing machine, finite, limited version of the sexual journey. People who understand that eroticism is only part of the process get to experience the expanded process. Now, as I mentioned earlier, a sustained and committed sexual relationship is not the only way this happens. It happens for single people as well. But it is the most common way that it happens in the human experience. And our young people need to know this is the bigger picture. We see agape love in couples who've been together for a long time. They have extended their ego boundaries. During mania, we drop those boundaries for a short time, but over a lifetime, learning all the stages of love, we circle back to the ecstasy that we glimpsed early on during mania. But instead of it being a temporary or artificial experience, instead of being limited only to the object of our affection, agape love becomes a permanent embrace of an ever-broadening world. So that book, early in my life, gave me a framework. It helped me understand the mystics that I wouldn't read until later in life, because mystics often conflate sexual language and spiritual language. They often blur the line between sexual experience and spiritual experience. Further along the journey, this broader definition of sexuality and spirituality start to converge. Here's an example, oneness. What is that? Is it a sexual term? Oneness, being one together. Is it a spiritual term? Oneness, being connected. Well, yes, it is a sexual term. Yes, it is a spiritual term. We begin to understand how sexuality and spirituality are linked as we go further on in the journey, as we deepen our capacity for love that is embedded right into our bodies and in our sexuality. Those who experience agape love report that the ecstasy and the bliss of agape love feels like mania love. Now, it's a gentler experience, to be sure. It's a lot less dramatic. It's a lot less debilitating than mania love. However, it is also more lasting, more stable, and it's ultimately more fulfilling. So, someone taught me this when I was in my 20s. They taught it to me at a time when I couldn't fully understand it. First, I was too young. I didn't have hooks in my mind on which to hang the things I was hearing. But even so, a deep part of me resonated with the vision. A part of me knew it was true, even though I couldn't fully embrace it. And I knew that what the author was describing was where I wanted my life and my sexuality and my love to take me. I understood then, even when I was in the throes of erotic fever, that my current sexual experience wasn't the whole picture. Now, I grew up in a little beach town in Southern California, and it was warm there all year long, so bikini season ran from April to October. It was a world of beauty and wonder. All my lovely schoolmates when I was in college were popping out of their bathing suits in all the right places, and I was overrun every day with erotic fever. But even then, I could hear a compelling vision of a life well lived. I understood that as powerful as erotic love is, as powerful as chemical attraction is, there is more to the journey. Hearing back then where the spiritual sexual journey takes us, I wanted to go there. I wanted to have sex, and I wanted to have sex all the time, and I still do. But I started to want a life well lived even more. From my youth, I have worked hard to learn the ancient sexual wisdom, and now this many years later, I understand what Peck was writing about. I understand what it feels like for my ego boundaries to extend. I can see how it was my sexual energy that has gotten me here. I understand love that is deeper and broader and more fulfilling the further on the journey we go, and this is a framework we can offer our young people. We can give them that broader understanding of their sexuality. We can help them anchor themselves to the journey. We can give them a broader framework that will point them toward each successive stage on the journey, help them savor and delight in each one, and help them carry each stage along with them in appropriate ways as they graduate from one to the next. We can help them not get stuck along the way. I want to give our young people a vision as big and as powerful as their eroticism feels now, that there is more. And I want them to be suspicious of the marketing machine's reductionist view of sexuality. I want to point them toward the full flowering of their sexuality. So let me finish up with a quick story. Here in Raleigh, in our own spiritual community, we're giving a lot of attention to this project on rethinking sex education, so I'm having a lot of conversations about sex these days. In an email conversation I had with a mom in our community who has teenagers, she told me this story. It highlights our need to give our kids a broader framework and to inform them of the end game for their sexual energy. So when I was a teenager, she wrote, my mother told me that sex was beautiful. She told me it was magical and it was a wonderful thing. She could not have been more misguided in telling me that. Because first, what hormonal kid wouldn't hear that and immediately set out to look for the magic? But second, she gave me no context to support what she was saying. So, of course, I did what teenagers would do. Off I went to find this beautiful, magical, wonderful thing. And boy, was I disappointed, she said. I mean, sex is okay. Feels good. It can feel really good if you do it right. But there's no magic. There's nothing beautiful, nothing wonderful. There was certainly nothing lasting. All there was a shallow kind of wonderful, a, yep, that feels good kind of wonderful. So after years of disappointment, I just came to the conclusion that Mom was wrong. It's good, but it's not magical. And then I experienced mania, she said. I experienced mania with my husband. I experienced chemistry. And then I experienced Philos. And we've been hammering out a life together, and now I've experienced Pragma. And now I begin to understand the framework, and now I understand the journey, and now I understand where eroticism fits in a way that really is magical. Now I understand, Mom. Sex is magical. This is what she was trying to alert me to. She was on to something, and something important. I just couldn't catch it. And now, she continued, I want to make sure I give my kids a better framework. I don't want them to miss the point. I don't want them to misunderstand and not understand that it's a journey. I want them to understand this journey takes us somewhere profound. I want to know them to know best practices for their sexuality, the best practice to get them to the end game. So, she said, hurry up and write that book. So that's the point of this podcast project. We really can give our kids a better framework. We can help them not reduce their sexuality. Now, all the truth we need is right there. It's in our ancient wisdom. We just have to dig it out, dust it off, and frame it in words that they can hear. So we'll pick up here next week. While I was away, several comments came in, so I'll do one more episode on the developmental journey of the Greeks, and then we'll move on to some of the more practical parts of sex and love. All right, next time.